When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Got a nice little microphone set up too.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, I was a podcaster for about a year, and my network gave me a bunch of cool equipment, and then canceled me 12 months later. So this is
wow.
Until they come and pry it from my cold dead fingers, I got this killer audio setup. You know, the Focusrite mixer over here.
I'm
got a bunch of cool shit going on here. Yeah.
Well, I saw you
solo USB hookup. Yeah.
Hey. Yeah. You know, at least you got something out of it. I mean, I saw you were. I think you're even still on the charts. Like I, whenever I look, I always see you, your podcast on the charts. And
oh, I'd be very pleasantly surprised to hear that. It was a blast. It was so fun. It was such a fun thing. It was just the downloads were not there. I don't need to tell you guys. It's challenging being heard. It's a somewhat saturated market.
Oh, 100%.
You guys started clearly like quite a few years ago.
Yeah. We've been doing it. Yeah. 2015, I think we started. So we,
oh my God.
It's
the same challenges though. I mean,
yeah,
it's cliche, you know, everybody, you know, two guys having a podcast talking about movies.
I tried to have like a little bit of a hook for mine, like, oh, it's a character actor. He talks to other character actors. And I think the people who dug it really dug it, but there were not enough of them.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Yeah, that's like such a niche thing, which I mean, I totally dig. Like, that's awesome. Like, because you, what were some of the names you had on your show?
Oh my God.
Because you did
Alfred
a similar
Molina,
thing.
We had, we had Martha Plimpton, Nestor Carbonell, we had Kurt Fuller, Stephen Root, Alex Desert.
Oh yeah.
We had a bunch of really, really good people. And it was nice too, because I think a lot of people hear character actor and they go, okay, it's Wallace Shawn and Stephen Tobolowsky and that list of older white guys. And that's fine. But I was trying to, you know, broaden the definition somewhat. And it just led us to some really cool conversations. I'm super, super proud of it. Household Faces was a blast. But it was also a ton of work, which I think surprised me, because I wanted to do good interviews. I've been interviewed by people who kind of have their head up their asses in the past, and it's not super enjoyable. So I wanted to step up a little bit. But that led to tons of homework.
Yeah.
If you're interviewing LA based,
tons of homework, huh? I mean,
yeah, no, I hear you. Yeah. The print is huge. It's like, you know, the man, I don't know why it's 240 pages, because I turned a 180 page manuscript. So let me just let the record show that if you do that in a 12 point font, it should not be that long. If you interview LA based character actors, you end up watching so much Bosch. You watch so much Bosch.
Yeah.
And Bosch is good. But I was watching it out of sequence, so I was like, wait, well, who is he mad at now? What's happening?
Why
is he about to lose his badge? So there were a lot of hidden challenges in that process.
Did you talk to Stephen Tobolowsky? You mentioned him.
I didn't. I could not nail him down because he works constantly. Wow. God bless him. But I had an in and everything. We had him.
I just got to one up you real quick.
All right, fine. Flex away. What did he talk about?
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
That was his film of choice.
But yeah, I could listen to he awesome storyteller. I could listen to him talk. And he basically did the show for me. I was just like, I'm just going to sit back, let him talk and do his thing. But yeah, anyway, yeah, I was just curious if you had him. Or what about Wallace Shawn? You mentioned him too. Did you have him?
Wallace was really hard to track down. I had one in, but it never, he doesn't strike me as the sort of guy who just checks his email.
Right, yeah.
You know, he really does not. That is not, I don't get the vibe from the guy who co-wrote My Dinner with Andre that he's really hooked on his phone, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I have no doubt that in 3 months' time, time, I'll get an email like, sure, I'd love to.
It's just, you know, he doesn't have to know you're not doing the podcast. You can just have him call you and, you know, just.
Because he also won't listen to it. So fuck it. I'll talk to Wallace Shawn for an hour and nobody has to listen.
Exactly.
Wallace Shawn in a forest and no one's around to hear it. Did it make a sound?
It's funny you should say that. I just watched My Dinner with Andre for the first time about a month ago, and it's good stuff, man.
It's an interesting piece of work.
Yeah, like
it really is its own thing entirely.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's literally My Dinner with Andre. Like, that's what it is. It is just two guys having dinner and talking. And it.
But there's a couple fascinating moments in it. The first off, in the first couple of minutes, he mentions that he's like 35. And I'm like, that's nonsense. You've been 60 your entire life. I will not. Exactly. I do not accept this one bit. That's amazing. And then just there's incredible footage of the subway in the 80s. And I grew up in Manhattan, as you having trudged through my book, you know this. But anytime you I'm reminded of the fact that, like, my mom had to tell me to be careful what I touched in that subway. I just look at it, I'm like, there was just gum everywhere. There was gum everywhere. And maybe it's led me to a better immunity, but man, what a time. But yeah, it's an interesting piece of work. It's very much of its time. In both the setting, the deliberate pace of it. You obviously could. I'm so glad it exists, because I don't think you could ever make it again, you know.
Oh, 100%. Well, and I got a kick out of it just because, or out of the one part, he does say inconceivable, which is brilliant because he,
I know, right?
Is basically, that's what he's most famous for. But anyway,
I stopped him on the I stopped him at a restaurant one time. I saw him in person years ago, and I was like, I got to go up and say something to Wallace Shawn, man. I got to go up and say something to Wallace Shawn. Because aside from his acting work, he's also a phenomenal playwright. He wrote a couple of plays I really love, including one called The Designated Mourner, which is beyond depressing, but is really, really good. And so I wanted to say something to him about it. So I go over to him, and there aren't a ton of people in this life that I tower over. But I fucking tower over Wallace Shawn. So I go over to the guy and I go, Mr. Shawn, and he looks up and goes, I'm sorry. And I go, no, I just want to say I'm just a huge, huge fan. And you could see the light go out of his eyes, because, like, this fucking Gen X douchebag is going to make me say inconceivable. This Gen X douchebag is going to make me say inconceivable. And I'm out with my wife in the West Village, and this asswipe, this born in 1971 tool bag, is going to make me. And I go, I just want to tell you, I love The Designated Mourner. It's one of my favorite plays. And the relief was palpable.
Oh,
like,
I bet.
Like, the air just came back into the room and everyone seemed to levitate somewhat. We all, like, hovered a little bit above the ground for a moment. It was a really nice moment.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's that you actually, yeah, had that experience with him. And I'm surprised you didn't lead with that when I asked if you had him on the podcast. That's great.
The idea of me coming up to someone and asking them to do their speech impediment, you know, off the clock is never. I would fucking never. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
I've been there.
No. Yeah. I bet. I bet you've been there. What's the most requested thing you do when people run into you?
Oh, they're actually fairly respectful, but now and again, someone will ask me to, there's a moment in Big Bang near the end of it's the Sheldon and Amy's wedding episode, where the only thing I do in that episode is sing At Last by Etta James. But of course, it's At Last. And now and again on Cameo, I will be asked to sing that for somebody's wedding. And I do so happily, because that's actually pretty sweet. And I also just loved that. And that episode is so near and dear to my heart, because it was packed with, I mean, the call sheet on that episode was fucking insane. I mean, Mark Hamill, Laurie Metcalf, Kathy Bates, Teller, Jerry O'Connell's there, you know, that Will Wheaton's there. There's a fucking Stand By Me reunion going on 3 feet from me. It was bonkers. So I am so fond of that episode and my experience that week that I will happily relive it, especially if it's for a special occasion.
I bet. I mean, for me, I mean, yeah, just Mark Hamill, I would just be.
Oh, he's so cool. You know. He's exactly what you want him to be. He's so fucking cool. Oh, my God. He's just, and I think it's, it's because it's been, it hasn't been a completely smooth road for him. You know, there were some lulls, and I just think it has grounded him. But, you know, again, I did something with Mark Hamill. I used my superpower of people's deep cut credits. And I was like, Mark Hamill, I just got to tell you, I mean, and again, 1971, look at me. Obviously, this guy's going to ask me to say that the force is with him or something. And I'm like, I saw you on Broadway in The Nerd, that Larry Shue play with Robert Joy, Patricia Callenberg. Great night of theater, man. Thank you so much. We talked like a half an hour about his time on Broadway. Fucking delightful. So great.
That's great.
So you can do the deep cut. That's your in.
And that should be everyone's in, by the way. If I may offer this one tip to you guys and your listener base, you want to grab someone's attention. Don't go for their most popular credit. If you've seen them in theater, if you've been in the room with them before and like they were on a stage and you were in the audience and you bring that up, you're going to hold their attention a lot longer.
Well, that I'm glad you said that, because I really wanted to mention when you played Lester Jane in CSI New York in 2004. Sure. Like, I was going to mention that, you know? Yeah. Like,
let's do most of the hour on that, actually. Yeah, so Lester's a complicated character. There's a lot of nuance in that role. Oh. That was, you know what? That was, there is a chapter in the book called "You Guys Think I Killed Her," because that was a line I kept having to say at auditions. Uh-huh. But the first time I booked a "You Guys Think I Killed Her" was CSI New York. I'm not sure if it's actually in the finished product, but it was definitely in the audition sides. And it was just, there was a period of time in my 30s where I just looked like a suspect all the time. I had not aged into the dad roles, but I was way too old for the grad student roles.
Right.
So I was just like creepy suspect, and every fourth audition had me saying, "What, you guys think I killed her?"
I'm glad we were able to, you know, I talk about that, because that's for the longest time that I've always wanted to ace you about that. So
sure,
thank Garrison you for Ace that.
Was nice. Yeah.
Oh, I've heard he's like one of the nicest guys in the world.
Really nice guy. And another, not particularly tall actor.
I don't know.
That's kind of, maybe that's why I got the gig, because I'm only 5'8".
I feel like you have a running list of all the actors you're taller than.
There aren't a fucking ton of them, dude. Okay. There are not a fucking ton. Minnie Driver's not on that list. So yeah, I absolutely cherish the rare actors that are shorter than me, and I'm very fond of them, and I've enjoyed working with them.
Oh yeah. You play her husband, and she's definitely taller. She's
5'10".
5'10". Wow, yeah, that's crazy.
You just can't tell when you're watching, really. And
yeah.
Everyone's height gets, it's all obscured unless people are like lined up right next to each other.
I never made a big thing about it, but she apparently has worked with actors, and she wouldn't name names, and even if she did, I probably wouldn't rat them out. But she worked with actors who would insist that that they don't stand on a box, but she stands in a hole. So they would look taller.
Interesting.
And I was like, I will do none of those things. I will. No, that's crazy. I'm not going to stand on an apple crate, but I'm certainly not going to ask you to, you know, we're not going to dig some sort of ditch so you can. No, that's insane. But apparently it happens.
Wow. It's such a weird world. I we hear little bits and pieces, and we never want to like press anybody because you say the wrong thing and your career's over or whatever, but like all like, you know, the egos, the demands, and like the weird stuff that people have that people in your line that have to kind of deal with and stomach and kind of move past. It's just whenever we get little stories like that, it just cracks me up.
You just have to find it funny. You just absolutely have to find it funny.
I can imagine.
Lose your mind, yeah. But if you find it funny, it's really funny. It's really, really funny. Yeah.
If you find it funny, it's funny. Yep. Go figure. Go figure.
Been your approach is to just not, is to take things as they are and then not take things too seriously.
I would love to tell you that I'm some sort of like Zen guy who just kind of floats through life, not getting upset with shit. But it is taking me a while to get here.
Yeah.
But I'm able to laugh a lot of stuff off now. And I've also been pretty lucky. You know, I haven't worked with like the people who throw shit or any of that. You know, I've obviously, you know, 100 plus credits, I've bumped into some sizable egos along the way, but most of the time I've been pretty lucky, and people have been friendly and chill, and or at the very least not mean. So yeah, I can't complain, you know.
How do you manage your stress on set?
I manage my stress on set. That's a really good question. I remember that it's a job, and that stress is part of work, and is inevitable. And while it is certainly the most fun job I've ever had, and I've had a few, I remember that just because someone else is being unprofessional doesn't mean I get to be, and that's okay. And I just try to stay focused and you know, find the person I'm supposed to be working with. You know, if they're being a dick, maybe I use that. You know, maybe if blank isn't sticking around for her coverage, then I can just go, well, I'm supposed to be sort of alienated from blank anyway. So fine, I'll just talk to her stand-in this way. And you find ways to cope. Or you quit and go into real estate.
Now, speaking of Dave loves my segues. Speaking of my
oranges.
No, but speaking of, you know, character actors, things like that. I see Fred Armisen has a quote for your book. Very nice quote, which is great. What's your relationship with him? Is he a friend?
Very recently. First off, Fred was one of the first people I met when I moved to LA before he was on SNL. We shared a manager. Neither of us are with the guy anymore, but we shared a manager, and he was someone I met at auditions. And then he booked SNL, and we loosely kept in touch, but he went off to the other side of the country to do his thing. And I was like, man, I just got here, and this guy I met has left. And his stuff on SNL was singular and weird and funny, and the level of experimentation he did on that institution is really striking, isn't it? You know, I just think of like the hallmark of his great bits was that they're so hard to explain. His bits on SNL were so solidly you had to be there. Do you remember the bit that him and Vanessa Bayer used to do where they were old friends with a dictator? And they, do you know the bit I'm talking about?
Yeah, where they secret, they like would, secret. They would never,
like, oh, he's great. He's great. Kim Jong-un is great. But I sometimes feel like he's not listening. And it's so hard to explain that bit to somebody.
Right. It's
like, you know, you're like, it's a weird person. You don't want to talk shit about them, but they're also responsible for genocide. And, you know, so,
right. Yeah.
And I love bits like that just do not translate at all.
That definitely is one of his, I feel like, his definitions of humor right there. Because I'm a huge fan of Portlandia, which I think needs to be more mainstream and people need to like it. But that wouldn't be too so punk rock for it to be, you know,
well, I mean, that's the
mainstream.
Whole problem, then, you know? that would defeat the whole purpose.
You're right, exactly.
He heard me on a podcast called Turned Out a Punk. That a guy named Damian Abraham does, who's the lead singer of a punk band called Fucked Up, and he's this incredible punk rock historian who interviews punk musicians, sure, but also people who America doesn't realize got their start in punk, like Fred, like myself, like Bill Hader, who's a massive Bad Brains fan, who knew? He reached out to me. He's like, "Oh, I don't think we've ever talked about this." And I said, "Oh yeah, no, I was familiar with Trench Mouth, his band." And so we've met for coffee a couple times. He's a sweetheart. I like Fred a lot. He's a really, really smart, interesting guy, and a bonkers talented musician.
Oh yeah, yeah, and his whole stand up for drummers, or I think that something along those lines. It's called
like very few people are like this, and Fred is one of them. Where is in either in Portlandia or in really anything he does, where you just. Just his face just makes you laugh. Like, because you
know,
like,
he is blessed with a certain look that is unconventional enough that it's sort of instant comedy, no question.
Yeah, and he's got, he has, it's not just, I mean, it's not just what his face looks like. He has an expression which, like, click something like, oh, okay, I know who this version of Fred is, and it just cracks me up every time. It's that rare ability to just put himself in whatever character or intention that he's playing for that one part. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it's really something to behold, and the idiosyncratic vision of both Portlandia and Documentary Now.
Mm-hmm.
Are such that, I mean, nobody else is doing what he's doing.
Right.
Nobody else is doing what, you know, there's people who go from SNL to different sketch, or they go on to do film work, or they go on to do a sitcom, and he has just completely blazed his own trail, and it's impressive. And he had a lovely, he was the one quote we had to drastically edit, because he gave me like a page of lovely shit, and I was like, this is great. You realize this is going to be book size. Like, this is going to be like a coffee table book, right? Like, a finite amount of room on the back. It was so, I mean, what a great problem to have to edit Fred Armisen's laudatory blurb.
He's like, this is how I get my book out, too. I write a book about your book.
He should have. God, I mean, that's the other thing. The one thing about writing a memoir is you get this weird sense of survivor guilt, because you're like, okay, I wrote a book. That's great. Where the fuck is Fred Armisen's book? Where the fuck is Fred Armisen's book? You hear him on like any one of the interviews he's done, and he's also lived a gazillion lives. He was married to a Mekon. I mean, it's endless with him. It's fascinating. Yeah, there's a lot of people who should be writing books, but I inexplicably got there first.
And of course, John's book is No Job for a Man. I was not lucky enough to receive a copy, but I did read the description of it. It's something about, I don't remember, I don't have it in front of me. It's something about a thankless or soulless job, copywriting. Part of
I won't say thankless, but it was definitely soulless. I mean, soulless, I was compensated for it, but it was pretty soulless. Yeah,
it just made me laugh because I've been. Part of what I've been doing for my job in different roles has been copywriting.
Oh no. I mean, it is what you make it. It depends on, I mean, are you doing freelance work?
No, it's always like a secondary part of what I do. So, but I get to at least it's not like traditional copywriting where it's super salesy. Mm-hmm. So which is better? That like that stuff, that is the soulless-est.
That's what I was doing. I was doing super salesy stuff for a famous consulting firm, and it was
it's the worst.
I was just helping them move money around. I was just helping them, like, okay, you're gonna hire a corporation's gonna hire this LLC to teach them how to do something, and people are probably gonna get fired in the process, and here's a paragraph on why we're awesome, and it was just killing me.
It's the absolute worst. And then like the people who are good at it, they're like the worst people in the world.
Ouch.
I have no further comment on that. I'm trying to think who the other copywriters were on my. Oh well, no, she was kind of garbage. Yeah, you're right. Now that you mention it,
yeah, it's the guy who tells you how his last thing that he sent out bought his new Rolex. It's that guy.
Oh, that's awful. The guys. It's funny, when I was working at this unnamed consulting firm, I was right near the guys who did graphics and did you know, all the design for the brochures and the mid-90s website for the firm. And those guys were kind of fascinating because they were all really cool, and they also could wear whatever they want because they were irreplaceable.
Yeah.
They were, you know, there was, if in a pinch, a partner could do what I do, could mm-hmm. step in and write a paragraph about whatever. But the guys in graphics were like, oh, I'm sorry, do you know Adobe Illustrator? No, you don't. So I don't wear a tie. That's how this works.
I like that.
So I'm here in a t-shirt today, and you're going to deal with that. Yeah, right, nobody else knows Photoshop.
Now, I'm always interested to know, like, was there a specific moment that you knew, like, why don't I write a book? Why don't I write a memoir? Was there a specific moment, or was it kind of just like, I'd like to write a book one day, and then it just sort of finally happened?
It's a reasonable question. There wasn't one set moment. I've always written, and I did like some personal essay stuff, and somewhere in this house, thank God they're not on soft copies. I just have hard copies of at least one terrible novel I wrote in my 20s. So I've always written, but I a literary agent, Todd Schuster, reached out to me a few years ago and said, I think you might have a book in you. Should we have coffee? And I thought, oh, I love coffee.
Well, I'll have
coffee with anybody who wants to have coffee with me. So we had some coffee and I started writing something that was going to be sort of a fluffy actor memoir. I'm not going to name any names, but there's a certain brand of like, oh, I vaguely recognize this person and here's their book and here's some wacky stories about Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And he pointed out like, this is okay, but your dad is a huge part in even in the margins of these stories. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that? And I said, not really. And he goes, I think you probably should. And so what happened was I got the title first, and the title was a quote that my father used to use about the acting profession. He used to say, well, Spencer Tracy used to say, acting is no job for a man. And I heard that phrase and thought, well, that's a terrible thing to say to your son. But also, this gives me very strict guidelines for the book now. If I use this title, and I think it's a striking title, if I use this title, then I basically am focused on jobs and manhood and my relationship with my dad. You know, it's all there. It's all there. So I chipped away anything that wasn't that. So whole chapters came and went because they really weren't on that theme of my relationship to work, his relationship to work. And I think what's, you know, there, it takes a certain amount of audacity to write a memoir. There's a constant, you know, editor over your shoulder, an internal editor that's saying, who the fuck are you? But what I think, what I hope distinguishes the book is that it's not some sort of like great Santini, mommy dearest tear down of my father, who's not here to defend himself. It's a little more complicated than that. This is a guy who had artistic aspirations of his own, I think, and wasn't able to follow through on them. And instead of being thrilled that his son was moving in that artistic direction, got a little jealous, got a little weird. And eventually we came to a sort of understanding of what, how we viewed work and how we viewed each other. So that's a very, very long answer. There was no one epiphany moment, but it came together kind of slowly and organically, and I think that's for the better.
Was it, I assume it was therapeutic in a way to write about these certain things. Was it therapeutic?
Yeah, it was. It feels almost cliche to say that, but it was therapeutic. Yeah. Because if you just sit down and look at the 6 or 7 huge events in your life, you're going to make a little more sense to yourself, and that will calm you down. That will make you feel a little less like you're, you know, sitting in the back of an Uber and the driver's on mushrooms, which is how life can feel sometimes. Yeah. It's like, I'm not in control. I don't know where this is going. Who is this guy? What the fuck? Did I even hit the right app? What is happening right now? But if you really sit down and go, okay, all right, interesting. Okay, so I grew up with this dad who has this job that he hates, but that's my example. Like, that's what's there. And that's what's right in front of me. That apparently to me is what being a grown up is. But he keeps introducing me to, you know, all this great TV and theater. And he takes me to see awesome movies and everything. And so I'm getting these sort of mixed messages of how this is an awesome thing to consume, but we shouldn't necessarily participate in it. And then everything in my life after that is this sort of push pull of like, what's responsibility and what's creative expression, and is there any possible way I can merge the two?
Yeah.
And not just be this incredible drain on society. Yeah, you just find yourself making a lot more sense. You find yourself drawn to certain themes in your life, and it can be a weirdly calming experience. It's a little anxiety ridden too.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But in a macro sense, you're like, oh yeah. My dad did this thing, and that's probably why I do this thing, and that's probably why my kids are going to go over here and do that thing.
Huh. Yeah. So how do you manage those messages that you're sending to your kids with all that in mind?
I try to expose them to as much joy as I can in my own job. I try to make sure they see me enjoying myself without, you know, being some sort of deadbeat dad who comes home at 3 a.m. I try to encourage them as much as I can without doting on them, which is a delicate balance. Don't give me, do you, either of you have kids?
Yes, I have three. Yep.
You have three. Okay. Have, yeah. So, yep. You know, there's that weird kind of balance between, I want to support this kid. I want to also set boundaries.
Yep.
I also want to set reasonable expectations, but I do want them to do better than me. That said, if either of my kids is a series regular before 30, they can go fuck themselves.
That said, yeah, I mean, that, at least they know, you know, at least they know.
Boundaries.
Boundaries, that's what it's all
boundaries,
about.
Boundaries, Benjamin.
That's right. Did now, I just got the book yesterday, so I have not finished, but was your dad able to see your success?
Some of it.
Okay.
Yeah. He'd been a smoker, and it caught up with him before he turned 70. He did, and I think he grew to understand that. I think he eventually grew to understand that there are a bunch of different ways to define success in this business, and I think he had the same misapprehension that a lot of people do, and that especially a lot of parents do, that there is no middle class in acting. Now, I hasten to add that when I say middle class, I don't mean middle class in any conventional sense of the term, but I mean that group of people that is not forced to wait tables, but is not living in Malibu and doing six movies a year. There is a bunch of us in the middle there who just, this is our job and this is what we do. And we qualify for insurance, and we don't have to have a day job, but we are not hugely famous, and a lot of us are still renting, and that's where we are. And I think my dad, via me, finally came to an understanding that that is not a bad way to live. And that it doesn't, acting can't be about constantly looking for fame and incredible fortune, because that will, I mean, you will almost likely be incredibly disappointed.
How do you deal with that precarity though? You know, you could be gone tomorrow. I mean, I hope you're not, but right, I mean, that's always in the back of your mind, right? I'm sure that's a big motivator. Well, but
it is, yeah. It is, but you know, I deal with that precarious nature by remembering that I was not good at my day job. And there's a certain security in knowing you can only really do one thing well. And that's a short, flippant answer. There's other things I do. I work on a podcast. Yeah. I keep writing. I keep occupied. I have irons in a lot of different fires. I for a while there, when I moved here, I was just getting sitcom work, which was great.
Yeah.
And I took a shine to it, but I kept pushing my agents. Like, I know I'm a tough sell because I don't have a bachelor's in theater, but I really want to try to go out for more Hour Lawn. Please put me out for more Hour Lawn. And they did. And I started booking that, and that made it that much easier for me to be sort of a reliable go-to guy. So it wasn't just, oh, he just does multi-cam sitcoms, that's just where he lives. I begged to be like, you know, let me be the murder suspect, let me occasionally work my way up to murderer, which I eventually did.
Yeah, give me child molester.
I know,
give me,
come something. On, yeah, I'm only the suspect.
I haven't
come
done
on.
Child molester, but I've done kind of dicey offender. I've done okay. Guy who, like, dude, she's 16, that's not okay. But I don't know when this is gonna stream, but as we're recording this tonight, I'm on station 19. I'm positive I'm gonna die. I've fought really hard to diversify as much as I could within this business, so that I'm not stuck in any one box. And I, you know, it's still hard to kind of get around that, but there was a lot of pushing of, like, you know, send me out. I want to start going out for the CSIs. I want to start going out for all these other Hour Lawn procedurals. Let's get me in a hospital bed. Come on, guys. Hop to it.
What was the name? Where is it? CSI. What was your name?
You're really airing on an episode of
Hold
Station
on. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on.
That's awesome.
Wow, that's crazy. Where's the CSI? Oh, hold on, guys. Peter. Yeah. Oh, no, that was CSI Crime Scene Investigation.
Yes, I've done. I've done two. I did CSI OG and CSI.
The New York one. Yeah, that's why, you know, I mentioned the New York one. But
are you still searching, or you got what you
want? No, it was my attempt at humor, and you know, it sometimes, you know, that's comedy, folks. That's showbiz. Sometimes it works, sometimes
it's
it doesn't.
Really,
you
erratic.
Know?
It's yeah, exactly. Exact science,
it's
man. It's an exact science.
Exactly. Are those procedurals are they factory line, or is it more involved or not?
I think
involved,
they. I think in the wrong hands they can be, but you have to recognize that you can't treat it like this is just another case of the week. You have to treat it like this is the craziest thing that has happened to this character probably in their life.
Yeah.
You know, even if it was just like they were in a restaurant where somebody got killed and they're being questioned by the police. That was something I've always really strict about. Like, I'm not going to be the guy who keeps, like, you know, there's that great John Mulaney bit about the people who keep moving crates while they're being questioned by the police. Like, no, I will stop my job. I will stop working to answer the questions of the homicide detective who have come into my workplace. Because I'm frightened by what might happen. I have never actually been questioned by the police, but I imagine it's a scary thing. So I try to keep it as not factory lined, as not cookie cutter as I possibly can, and realize, like, this is going to be the craziest thing that happens in this guy's lifetime.
I love it.
Great stuff. We'll talk a little bit more about the book in a little bit, but we have people who are
no job for a man.
No job for a man. November 8th, right?
It's actually November 1st. My
thing says November 8th. All right,
I know, but I just talked to the publisher's publicist. Man, that's
publisher's
rough.
Publicist.
Publisher's there, publicist.
Yeah. Okay. Ugh.
And I have like a bit of a sibilant ass too, so it really, that's a beast.
Yeah, that's a toughie. That's a toughie.
I talked to the lady who does marketing for the book people, and that person said November 1st, and I just went to a neighborhood bookstore and signed a bunch, and they're like, we put these out on the shelves on Tuesday, November 1st. I'm like, okay, I'll take your word for it. Here we go.
Excellent.
Love it.
Doesn't matter. If you pre-order it, it'll get there when it gets there.
Exactly. It'll get there when it gets there. That's my motto. We'll plug that again, obviously, a little later. Obviously we want to get to our niche is having people on who are in the business come on and talk about one of their favorite films or a favorite film. And you chose Edgar Wright's and I guess Simon Pegg's Shaun of the Dead. That's which correct. I was thrilled when that was your choice. What made you choose this film?
Shaun of the Dead is a movie I saw on opening night here in LA with a packed house, which is a terrific way to see that movie, where no one knows what's coming and everyone's really enjoying themselves. And there's a theater here that closed during the pandemic called the Arclight, fairly famous theater. It was behind the Cinerama Dome, the very famous Hollywood landmark. And back then, there were two things going on. I was still drinking. I hadn't quit yet. And they had an over 21 screening where you could bring a cocktail into your...
Perfect.
So I had a nice little buzz on, and I went in to watch Shaun of the Dead with my new wife, and it was just such a transporting, joyous evening at the movies. It's such a great movie. It's made with so much love for movies and music to a certain extent. It loves actors. There's just a ton of joy that goes into that film.
Yeah.
We just lost Dave.
I got a stupid camera.
His camera. Okay. It's no big deal.
we
don't need to see him.
Yeah, you don't need to see my face.
But what strikes me about Shaun of the Dead that I think is so special is that there are actually quite a few horror comedies out there of varying levels of quality. But, you know, I grew up there.
Yeah.
Like Saturday the 14th. And then you get a little bit past that. You get to American Werewolf in London. To a certain extent, depending on your mood, maybe Scream is a horror comedy. Tremors works as a horror comedy. And I love every movie I've just mentioned. But and they're all scary and they're all funny. Shaun of the Dead does this incredible trifecta where it's funny and scary and then moving.
Yes.
In a way that is unheard of for the genre and shouldn't work, but does based on the work of those actors. But the arc of Shaun and Ed and Shaun and his mom in that movie is, I'm getting a little verklempt talking about it. It's so well done. You the laughs land, the scares work, and then when it's time for you to like feel a sense of loss, that works too.
Right.
And I'm really, really hard pressed to think of another film that does that.
Yeah, I have to agree. It's funny you mentioned Scream because I was kind of thinking this is sort of like Scream in the sense that it's very self-aware of what it is and it's not taking itself too seriously. And it signals to you, the viewer, not to take it seriously as well. But then it does actually have, like you said, those little tiny heart moments. There's actually some characters that you really do care about in this movie, whereas Scream, you really don't give a shit about anybody.
Everyone's cute, so you don't want anyone to die. Like, I don't want to see Neve Campbell get hurt. I watched Drew Barrymore die earlier, and that wasn't fun.
Right.
But, you know, she's Neve Campbell. She's adorable. She's Canadian. Why would I wish her harm? You know, so you're rooting for her, but you don't have, like, that emotional connection that you do with Shaun and Ed and all the characters, Diane, Liz, all of them. Yes, I did all double check the names before I signed on. everyone in the movie has a moment. Yeah, it's also a great ensemble piece.
Absolutely.
Switching sentences here because yes, it is called Shaun of the Dead. Shaun is absolutely the main character, but it's one of those wonderful movies where everyone has a moment. Rafe Spall has like one thing as a flunky employee in the first half hour, right. And he's great. And he sets up a callback that runs through the entire film that you've got red on you. That whole thing that starts with Rafe Spall's brief scene in the beginning before he lost all the weight.
Right.
And then he, before he got all Life of Pi on us. Everyone has a great little moment. Tamsin Grieg has a tiny little moment where she's fantastic, and it's Lucy Davis from The Office is so good. Oh my God, she's so good in that
right.
movie.
And, yeah, well, you even have, he's only in it for tiny, another one from The Office.
Martin Freeman is in it.
Yeah, Martin Freeman, thank you, yes.
Martin Freeman shows up. Bill Nye, at the peak of his Bill Nye powers. The music, it's so engineered for me too, because I love what it's saluting. I love the zombie genre that it's saluting. And to not mansplain to my wife was a failed endeavor. I did mansplain to my wife because I'm sitting there and the first two music cues you hear are the opening theme from Dawn of the Dead, which segues into the Specials' Ghost Town, which are two jokes that I almost stood up at the theater like, I get this. I have a couple drinks in me and I get this movie, which is a fun to be married to. But the sense of we should put that in without it going to the absurdist lengths of an Anchorman or an Airplane and still just being this love letter to the zombie genre. Built on genuine relationships and with a weird little bit of social commentary too that only gets more prescient. The opening credits, after there's that cold open in the Winchester, and then it's morning and you see them, the London sort of come awake. But the joke is that everyone's on their phones. Everyone's just standing there waiting for the buses. We're all zombies already.
Yeah, everyone's already zombies. Yep.
We're already zombies, man. They warned us in 2004. The fucking iPhone wasn't even out yet.
I know. That's what's crazy.
They fucking warned us. It's a masterpiece. The more I'm thinking about it, the more I'm talking about it, the more I'm so glad I picked this one.
There's so
and
many.
Even Shaun doesn't become self-aware of his zombie nature because at the end of the movie, because we see that in the beginning, his stumble, and he's still doing it even after everything he went through.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because at the end of the movie, I can't believe if you'd be listening this far into the podcast if you haven't seen Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah, that goes without saying.
I'm about to spoil it. The end of the movie, of course, ends with him going out to the shed out back where he has somehow rescued a zombie Ed. And as long as he keeps his distance, the two of them are still able to play video games together, which is a lovely,
makes
lovely
sense.
Ending.
Yeah,
and, but what's interesting is that there is a sense now of that not being a checkout from reality. That's about him savoring this time with his friend. That's about him staying in the moment a little more often. The scene right before that is him and Liz just going to sit around, and they're going to do the crossword, and then maybe they're going to swing over to the Winchester, and they're just going to just enjoy, realize that every single day is a gift.
Yeah,
and, absolutely. And that's also a lovely message to take out of the movie theater.
100%. Yeah, there's so many different, like you said, layers to the film that, you know, seems like it's going to be just like a slapstick comedy. But then there's like they add the layer of emotion to it. And what's crazy to me is, you know, the whole film, he's like, you know, saying, you know, about he's not my real dad. He's not my dad, you know, about Bill Nighy. Like, and then that's like the first tear that shed in the movie is him talking to him, and you see like a tear like coming down his eye, like he's fully like, you know,
because he knows how much Philip means to his mom,
right?
And,
yeah,
Penelope Wilton from Downton Abbey. What the cast is insane.
It really is.
The cast is fucking insane.
You had mentioned about you know, shout outs to old horror movies. I think my favorite is when he says when he calls his mom, Barbara. You know me. You
was
know me.
Yes. I screamed. Yeah, the mom is called Barbara, and when they're worried that Philip's been bitten, they scream into the phone, "We're coming to get you, Barbara," which is a callback to the original Night of the Living Dead, where Johnny the brother says, "They are coming to get you, Barbara."
I was just a little tidbit, a little factoid. My mother introduced me to Night of the Living Dead. Her name's Barbara.
I saw it with my mom too.
Get out of town.
I saw it with my mom for the first time at a revival house in Manhattan.
Wow, that is awesome.
It was her first time as well. We went together.
Okay.
It was. Well, it wasn't quite her introducing me, but we went together, and she loved it.
Yeah.
She was like, "My God, that's a Greek tragedy. That's so good."
Yeah. Well, yeah. My mom's name is Barbara, and she introduced me to it. And her sisters used to antagonize her because they would always say, like, in the middle of the night, like, "We're coming to get you, Barbara."
Oh,
and,
no.
Yes.
Oh, that's horrible.
So, yeah. So that's it was my introduction to that. So when I heard that, you know, in this film, I'm like, "Oh my God, they said
I
it!"
Screamed in the theater.
It's so great.
I was like, and asshole who stood up during the first music cue. That's dipshit.
Well, I also love too that the movie knows, you know what it's about, you know it's a zombie film going in.
Yeah.
So like they keep playing with you. They, you know, Edgar Wright keeps like doing these like fake jump scares, like it's gonna, oh this is where, you know, the first zombie's gonna come, this is where, and it's like, no, he makes you wait for it, you know. And I love that technique.
And they also do the other thing that's amazing, and that it came up a little bit at the time, but it does that, oh, we're going to act like zombies and we're going to walk through the zombies and that's how we'll get away with it. And they do that a couple years before the comic Walking Dead comes out or the TV show comes out. And the TV show, they have to make it gross and it's about the smell and they cover themselves with dead people and that's how the zombies ignore them. But the thought of losing that moment where Lucy Davis is giving them the rundown on how to act like a zombie and like getting really into the character. And that's like, oh, I'll do it on the night. This is the night. Everything about that moment is just gold. It's just like when they talk about like the fun and games of the second act of a screenplay, like that is a perfect example of fun and games. Like they have to sneak through the street to get to the Winchester by acting like zombies. And we get to see the acting class that precedes it. It's gorgeous.
It's perfect. I love slow zombies are the best. They're better than the.
Oh yeah, we're not even talking about it. I mean, I'll give it up for the Dawn of the Dead remake was better than it had any right to be, no question.
Yeah.
And there's moments in the 28 later movies that.
Yeah, 28 Days Later. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I'll give it up.
But
for
yeah,
that one.
Generally speaking, I think Simon Pegg gave an interview one time where being a zombie is a handicap, not an energy drink.
Yeah, exactly. I love that.
I am inclined to agree with it. Also, just doesn't really make any. I mean, these people are still decaying, right? I mean, they're not necessarily going to be sprinters.
Well,
exactly.
You know, none of it really makes sense, but
I should give the logic police the night off, regardless. But
you know, as great as the ensemble is, I mean, Simon Pegg is He's so awesome.
He's so awesome. And I feel like here's a guy who, just to kind of call back to what I was talking about earlier, here's a guy who was doing a very, very good Britcom in the form of Spaced, but was probably not getting a chance to show his range. And I think one of the reasons the film came to be is like this gave Simon Pegg a chance to show that he could be genuinely scared and genuinely moved and genuinely angry. And he goes through every stage of grief in the course of an hour and 40 minutes. And he's fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, he's so good.
It's a phenomenal performance.
Yeah. He was able to show his acting chops and all that. Because what was he did a series before this? I think
Spaced.
Spaced. And I think they even had like a zombie episode and everything. And
they might have. Yeah. But it's him and Nick Frost and Edgar Wright. And it's very much. And what's her face? Oh, God. I actually met her one time. The woman who saves the day at the end. His friend. She's not the love interest, but she's the woman that shows up with the army at the end of the movie. I can't remember the actress's name. Julia.
It's me. I can't. It's not even on IMDb. Come on, man. Anyway, but yeah, we know who you're talking about.
We do.
Yeah. She was on Spaced, which is magnificent. And sometimes it's one of those things that kind of comes and goes from the streamers kind of erratically, but is completely worth checking out.
I'll have to check it out. Yeah, I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's a really good piece of work.
It's funny. A few months ago, I don't know, Chekhov's gun came up. And I like looked up like what are like the best uses of Chekhov's gun in film, and you know, when you chose this, it brought me back to that because this is like number one on every list, the Winchester rifle. Yeah. Uh-huh. Which is like basically Chekhov's gun thing. If you show a gun in the first act, you have to go off
in the last one. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
She was Jessica Stevenson at the time. She is now Jessica Hines.
There you go.
I think we're all the same. We're all the kind of person who would not have been able to sleep.
Right. No, 100%. Yes.
I feel like I'm speaking to my kin here. So I think all of us would have just walked around our individual houses all night, clawing at the walls. Jessica Stevenson.
There we go. I can sleep tonight.
John, are you a fan of what they call, is it the Cornetto trilogy and Hot Fuzz and World's End?
I am. I Shaun of the Dead is such a masterpiece that anything after that is going to be diminishing returns to a certain extent. But they all have incredible, incredible moments. And I want to go back to watching Hot Fuzz because I've not watched Hot Fuzz since I watched The Crown, and I want to go back and watch Funny Olivia Colman.
Oh, right. Yes.
Because
Queen I miss Funny Olivia
Colman, and she's one of the cops in Hot Fuzz, along with Patty Considine. We were on the brink of a Timothy Dalton comeback for a moment there, and I don't know what happened there. Maybe for all I know, he's working in British TV all the time and doesn't.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like you never quite know.
Yeah. But I want to go back and watch Hot Fuzz again because I remember enjoying a lot of it.
I will say Olivia Colman, The Favorite, no matter what you think about that movie or if you've even seen it. But anyway,
she's great in it.
Yeah, like it's subtle humor. Like it's like she has a lot of subtle humor in that film.
A lot of her subtle
like
humor to contrast some very not subtle and occasionally nauseating camera work. I don't mean that.
Yes.
I'm probably not going to work with him anyway, but there's moments where it's like, hey, look at what this cool lens can do. And I remember sitting there in the theater just being like, oh my God, I'm so car sick. What is happening? But she is magnificent in it.
Don't worry. He doesn't listen to this podcast, so you can say whatever you want.
Is he a regular subscriber?
Well, no. I don't think so, John. Timothy Dalton. I just came across this today. I don't know if you watch Yellowstone or any of the spinoff series. Well, they have an upcoming spinoff limited series called 1923 with Harrison Ford and Helen Mirren. Timothy Dalton's actually going to be in that series.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Maybe I'll start there. What if I start there? Would that be weird?
Don't
start there. Go back and do Yellowstone. Okay.
You gotta kind of, well, there's Yellowstone, which is like four seasons.
And then there's 1883
with Tim McGraw. Tim McGraw, yeah. It's fantastic. It's like 10 episodes. And then they're following up it follows basically the story of one family.
Yeah, it's organized crime on the frontier, right? Essentially, am I being a little reductive? But that's
about right. But okay. there's an interesting through line between the people who settled this land and became ranchers versus the Native Americans who had that land before, and it's an ongoing tension. And then just, you know, fights over this, what is basically paradise on earth, and who wants the land and who's going to. It's fantastic. But you know, my endorsement doesn't count because I haven't been able to get Ben to watch a goddamn episode of any of it. So
I want to, I just haven't yet. Does 1883 direct, like, can you tell it's connected? Like, do they make obvious connections to it? Or?
It's a ancestor of the family, but I don't think you wouldn't. I mean, 1883 is fantastic, but what would be like, if you would watch Yellowstone, it's a 10. If you watched 1883, it would be like a 7, just because you don't quite get the full context of what it might mean for the future.
Gotcha.
Not that kind of a thing. So, okay. I mean, you can watch it. I mean, go fuck, man. Just watch anything. I don't care. Watch it out of order. Just watch anything.
Just whatever,
what to
man.
Do, man. Dave, stop telling me what to do.
Yeah.
State.
Can't believe how you treat a guest. Quick, you know, layer about this film is, you know, Simon Pegg, you know, he's not on Ed's level, you know, where he's a total, whatever you want to call Ed,
total fuck up,
waste of space. Yeah, yeah, fuck up. You know, it's
he kind of wants to be, though.
Yeah, but he's still like he loves Ed and everything, but he wants to make his girlfriend happy, and you know, but he's got some, I guess, growing up to do, or, you know, just kind of responsibilities he's got to have. And this, like, apocalypse kind of brings that out in him. Liz is able to see, like, oh, man, he can take charge. Like this is kind of his redemption, way of redemption, which I love, too. Like, it's another layer. Like, this movie's about redemption. It's about, you know, feeling lost. It's about, you know, there's
growth.
Just...
growth, yeah, coming exactly. of age at 30 plus.
Yes, exactly.
No, which is crazy. He says he's 29 in this movie. I'm like, man, I feel so freaking old.
British is weird, though. British people, I don't know. It's not sun exposure, but British people age differently. I'm just going to say that. I don't want to get into details, but years ago, I used to point out all the time, it's less funny now, but I used to point out all the time that Maggie Smith was 10 years younger than Betty White, and she is.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, no, look at
Oh my God. Look yeah, that's insane.
Now, obviously, that's a little less striking now, but it does speak to there's something in the water, or I don't know. Anyway.
And you got, again,
I threw you with that. I can feel it. I really threw you with that fact.
Well, I just thought you had it handy.
I love the. love the details. Not to get too deep here. So, like, you know, he has like this sort of heart to heart with his father. Was there a certain thing you wrote in your memoir that you never said to your father or wish you had?
No job for a man, by the way.
I wish I had. Yeah, there is, actually. And there is a moment in the end where things kind of come full circle in a way that people are going to be like, that's bullshit, but I swear to God it happened the way it did, the way it's presented in the book. I kind of wish I'd been able to tell him to worry less in general, about me, but also just in general. I do wish I'd been able to say that, but I was able to, because he was having kind of a long goodbye with emphysema, I was able to say a lot of things, and he was able to say a lot of things because we knew time was short.
Right.
And I'm super grateful for that. Yeah. And my father, who, let it be said, also enjoyed Shaun of the Dead, did live to see Shaun of the Dead and did
That's
enjoy
good.
It very
That's
much.
Good.
Yeah, yes. That's a total win. That's a total win. But he, I think I got a chance to say a lot of things. Here's something I really wish, though. I do wish he'd gotten to watch me become a dad. So I could have been like, hey, I might have been kind of rough on you. This is a hard job.
Right.
I really kind of wish I had. Yeah. OK, so I want to just kind of get my side of the street in order here for a moment, if I can. I was a challenging son. And now as someone with some challenging kids, I see what you went through a little more clearly.
I
really wish we'd had it, because I did get a chance to say that to my mom, which is great.
My mom
watched me become a dad to both my kids, and I was able to say a lot of things to her, and that's in the book, and thank God for that. But my dad died very soon before I became a father myself, so there was no overlap there. That's one thing I regret, but depending on your spiritual background, I'd like to think there's some bit of energy out there that is rare that I've learned a lot.
Is that what you believe? Not that we have to get deep into it, but is that
I kind of have to,
you
know, is it what I believe? I don't know. You know,
I hope,
you know, I so much happened in the year my dad passed in terms of me becoming a father. And I remember being on the couch with my newborn, feeding her, dozing, watching a then brand new TV show called Mad Men, and saying to my wife, like, holy shit, my father would have loved this show.
Yeah.
And my wife saying, like, I bet he's watching it, you know, and she's not a deeply religious person either. You know, she isn't a big concept of the afterlife, but we were both like, because he's Pete Campbell's age, man, he would have fucking loved this show.
Right.
Would have fucking loved this show. So, yeah, I like to think there is some sort of sense of awareness out there or enlightenment that comes with our transition. I don't know. We got deep, dude. This got intense real fast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. He'd be watching it, and, you know, like, see, this is a job for a man right here. Don Draper. Don Draper. That's
entirely. Oh, God.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because I guess it finally clicked for me is, and what the tension is for you is the fact that he actually does have, he knew what was good and he knew all of it. But yet, you know, it wasn't as if he was like, that's all crap and you shouldn't get into it. You know,
there wasn't a sense of like, I mean, he wanted me to, you know, I think my father had the same misconception that like, oh, well, if you want to do Shakespeare, you sign up at the Shakespeare place. And, and that's how that works.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to Shakespeare on Broadway, oh, that's a different list. You just walk down the hall and you sign up over there and then you get to do Shakespeare on Broadway. And that's how that works. So
you do your orientation.
But I think he got to a point where he saw that I was doing fairly good work, that I was growing a little bit as an actor. And yeah, he was a fan. He's the reason I do this stuff.
Yeah.
He would take me. There was a place in New York that when I was a kid was called the Museum of Broadcasting and then became the Paley Center for Media. And we would watch old TV shows. I mean, old, like your show of shows, that was the week that was Laugh-In, stuff from the 50s and 60s, dawn of TV type shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because he was sort of an amateur historian as well of these things. He got me into the good stuff. He recognized the good from the bad. And he was not a complete snob. He loved a ton of multicam sitcoms, and I think he would have eventually really enjoyed Big Bang Theory had he lived to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a sense of like, you know, we're Puritans and you will not use the devil's medium. I think it was a sense of like, shit, this is what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Right.
And that's hard. That's, and that's a hard thing for a father to admit. And he did admit it. And I got a little pissy about it. But I think it was I think he realized that I was sort of fulfilling our own version of an American dream, in the sense of like, oh, this thing you got me into, I do it for a living now. That's how I feed my kids.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Great stuff. John, I want to do a quick time check. Because now we're at 8:30. We don't want to take too much your availability.
Like another 10? Want to do another 10?
Okay. Yeah.
Is that cool? Yeah. I also feel like
what do you have else to say?
Get into your like your 90-minute 2-hour podcast. I mean, I don't.
Yeah, I know. That's
maybe if I'm driving down to San Diego to see my aunt. Maybe.
Yeah.
But like, I think you know, hour 10. That's a good.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we get it done in a half hour. It just never happens.
Yeah, sure.
Definitely. Yeah, Dave's always like
the movie, and that I know. I'll own that.
Yeah, John, that. What
the hell, John? You know,
I,
no,
I
it's
tangented like a motherfucker. I know.
We love it. That, like, I'll you know, I'll like be like, all right, I'm gonna start getting in the movie at this point, probably in the podcast. But if a guest is talking and they're giving me interesting things, like it's like,
it's great.
I love it, man. Yeah, it's it's and I just like having a flowy conversation, seeing where it goes, you know, just go with the flow, you know.
I think we were pretty flowy. I think
we were flowy.
Yeah, I think the flow was happening.
I mean, do you have any I mean, Dave, you I'm not to call you out, but I feel like you haven't had much to say about the movie. Do you have anything we haven't talked about yet that you wanted to mention?
Yeah, I mean, with the guests monopolizing the whole discussion.
Yeah, geez, like, come on.
I think for me, what I love, I mean, everything that's already been said, but I love the buildup. I was kind of talking about the hints of, like Ben, you said it's a zombie movie, but I just like, you know, they're going through their lives and there's this like disaster happening just out of reach.
Yeah,
you know, slowly, it's not like it's 5 minutes, it's like a third of the movie before it becomes real, you know.
They take their time and it's interesting the way they ramp up the tension and the satire at the same time by having just weird moments of like, he's on the bus and he watches people just fall over in the park. Or the thing we mentioned earlier about just all the people just kind of staring at their phones and checked out anyway. Yeah. But there's that amazing tracking shot when he wakes up just toxically hungover and goes down to the, what do they call it in London? They have a word for it. Because it's a bodega in New York. I don't know what you
call it. I have no idea.
He goes to the convenience store. And there's that great gag where he slips in the blood and doesn't notice it.
Right.
Yeah.
And gets his Cornetto, hence his little.
There's
little,
blood on the case.
Blood on the cabinet. He just throws his money down, not noticing that there's no one behind the counter, or if there is, they're dead. Yeah, it's one wonderful bit after another, but that tracking shot should be discussed in the same hushed tones that the one at the beginning of Touch of Evil is. You know, it is magnificent, and so, and it kills in front of an audience. Oh my God.
Even the clear zombie is like, oh, I'm sorry, I don't have any change on me. Like,
you just see yourself doing that.
Like, right, yeah.
You know,
like you just get lost in your...
Yeah, it doesn't. If the zombie apocalypse does happen, it's probably going to go down like that. You're just going to be, you know, in the aisle of a grocery store, you know, putting your oranges in a bag, and then there'll be a zombie next to you. You know,
yeah, seriously. So, and like, we have a stock boy will suddenly collapse or you know, bite into your neck or something. Yeah, no, yeah. I fully expect that's how it's going to go down.
I love that. Yeah. I love. Go ahead, Ben.
No, I was just going to say that you also before we actually see a confirmed zombie, there's like this like homeless guy in the park and it looks like he's about to eat a pigeon. Like, but you don't know though. You still don't know at that point.
Is he just a person or is it one of the first zombies?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Like it's, that's what I love too. Yeah. It's just like, you know, something's coming, but it's like, oh, is this the moment? Is this the moment? Like I said, it's just, yeah.
A classic disappear behind the bus.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Good. Like, so oh, he's gone.
Beyond all that, I mean, the setup is, I think that's almost 90% of what makes this movie so good, because it builds anticipation. You get to know the characters, and then it's, all right, we're going. But it is the relationships. It's how these characters relate to one another. And I think, John, you mentioned it. This movie is made with care. This movie was not made to be, it might have been, you know, marketed as or perceived initially by the audience as, this is just a silly, fun comedy horror. There's much more to this, and even a little bit of satire. You know what I thought? I was thinking, Ben, this movie reminded me of, we get to like after the end of the movie, it's almost like a postscript where they have the zombies are like, they're not all dead, but they're still useful. We could put them to work at like Walmart or something.
Yes.
Oh yeah, they're at work at supermarkets. There's game shows where you can bet on them.
Yep.
There's a Zed Day has become a bit of a thing. Yeah.
It's, yeah.
Yeah, it's just making
like
use
a little
of
bit of an homage to Paul Verhoeven to me, you know, because you'd see little bits of that in his films. So I thought,
yeah, there's a soupçon of like RoboCop in there,
yeah,
or maybe even Starship Troopers. You're right. That's a really interesting point. I've never thought about it that way, but there is a sense of like, seriously, how would the media take this? What would the media do with this? That's really interesting. I've never considered that, but you're absolutely right. Yeah. Wow. Huh.
You even have, especially back then, Coldplay was huge. Like, they have a quick snippet of Chris Martin, the frontman of Coldplay, like having like a Zed Day shirt on or whatever.
He's about to do
and,
a benefit. Like, apparently, yeah. Go to the IMDb page. I haven't noticed it. I'll have to watch it again. He's apparently uncredited as a zombie outside the Manchester as well.
Okay. Yeah. So that's fine. There you go. Yeah. I mean, I can. Have you, in any of your roles, have you had to put on crazy makeup like that?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Benjamin, because as it happens, tonight I play a burn victim on Station 19.
Oh, yes, Station 19.
It was an hour and a half in the makeup chair getting... It was incredible craftsmanship to watch up close. It was like one of those reasons why it's fun to be both a fan and a practitioner of this business, because... Yeah. They had their burn lady. There's like the lady who's like, oh, she's the burn lady. It's incredible. And the combination of just art and craftsmanship that went into making it look like my legs were so fucked up I could not walk. there's like a combination of like the black makeup to make it look charred on top of a layer of sort of like liquid skin kind of stuff, like the stuff you would, like a liquid bandage sort of thing. Yeah. But then the liquid bandage is torn up to make it look like it's gotten into, and then everything underneath that is shaved and pink. And so you look at it, you're like, oh, you almost, this is going to sound really like artsy and gross, but you almost are like, oh God, looking at this, my legs almost hurt.
Yeah.
Like, this makeup is so good. My legs almost hurt. It was so incredible. The work that went into, and again, 90 minutes over 2 days to get, or 90 minutes one day, 90 minutes the second day, to get my legs looking like that, and people coming in and taking photos and be like, I feel like we need a little more char up here on his upper thigh.
Yeah. Like, no, it already hurts.
Get in there, you know?
So
stuff like that, I find it's so fun. Because no, I have not actually had a chance to do a lot of prosthetic work or anything like that. The one thing and this is in the book, I did the very last day of the Santa Claus 3, the Disney film with Tim Allen. And Tim Allen, who is a, you know, famously mercurial gentleman, he apparently, I don't know, depending on who you ask, he didn't seem that keen on doing a third Santa Claus, but he was contractually bound to do it. And he had to spend like 2.5 hours in the makeup chair getting done up. And at the end of that, what you had was an incredibly irritable Kris Kringle, which is hilarious. My day, it was is sort of his George Bailey moment of what if he'd never become Santa Claus and
he's
a miserable Scrooge like prick, and I'm his coworker, his Bob Cratchit, whatever. It's fun. It airs every Christmas, and then I get a weird little check in February. Nice. But I always thought that was like the worst prosthetic situation ever, to like spend 2.5 hours getting made up to look like Santa Claus and then being really pissed off about it.
Right. Yeah, I bet. Yeah. What I mean, I don't even have to air any of this. Is Tim Allen cool, or is he like,
he was, you know, it's hard to say because he was perfectly pleasant to me and complimentary of my work. He said a couple things that made me a little uncomfortable while I was on set. Everyone's really litigious these days. I had it in the book, and they were like, eh. And I was like, you know what? I can take it out. That's fine. Here's a funny story about him in makeup. And they're like, that's fine. Why don't you do that?
Oh, man.
Like, because he also said blah, 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 and also blah, blah, blah. And he did it in a blah, blah, blah voice. And they're like, yeah, you know what? Let's leave that out. And I'm like, okay. Let's not get Simon & Schuster caught up in any sort of legal shenanigans.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, I want to know the details so bad now.
They're bringing back the series on Disney Plus.
They're bringing it back as a series, and maybe they can do it all digitally now, and it will take less time. I don't know.
Seriously.
I have no further comment.
And I think that's a perfect way to end the show. Yeah. John, any final thoughts on Shaun of the Dead?
It's great, and I want to watch it again. It's great, and I definitely want to. What I want to do is I've shown it to my kids. I made the mistake of showing it to them at the beginning of the pandemic, however, when like, hey, here's this great thing where everyone's terrified of the outside world, so they cram themselves into a, oh, shit. What have I done? Not a great choice. And I own that.
I, but, as, hey, as well, long actually, as you own it.
Yeah, no, Walter, come here for a sec. Shaun of the Dead when we showed it to you, like right at the beginning of the pandemic. It wasn't that bad. You're okay. It's funny, right? And didn't screw you up that we watched it like right at the beginning of quarantine. No, you're okay.
No, Dad, this is something I'll tell my therapist in what 10 years.
What was that? We were just talking about that, how it's sort of a weird little satire. Really? Just now? He was hanging about with his friends nearby. And that was that's the whole message of the beginning of that movie, that scene where everyone's wandering around in the credits staring at their phones. And you know what? That movie came out 3 years before the iPhone. Those aren't even smartphones. Those are like Blackberries. Crazy, right? Yeah. Walter Bowie, ladies and gentlemen.
There you go. Love it. But man, it's I really appreciate you coming on. This has been an absolute blast. Hope everyone picks up the copy of No Job for a Man, coming out November 1st. November 1st, 11/1/2022. It's been an absolute blast. Where can people find you on social media or anything? Or
I'm at John Ross Bowie on Instagram, and details will be posted there.
Bada bing, bada boom. But yeah, man, thanks so much for coming on.
This was delightful. Thanks for having me, guys.